Most of you recollect, I expect, in this connection, Carlyle. Carlyle wrote a famous book called Heroes and Hero Worship, and he makes the statement in that book and also elsewhere that history is the biography of great men. And for quite a while, this was a very fashionable point of view, a very fashionable way of looking at history. And if one turns from the more serious to the less serious disciplines, if one turns from the study of history to the popular novel of the day, the fiction of the day, one found that every novel had to have its hero. Without a hero, there was no novel. To a certain extent, that when Thackeray, the really great novelist of the middle part of the last century, published his novel, Vanity Fair, he gave it the subtitle, A Novel Without a Hero. Because in those days, that was something extraordinary. When you started reading a novel, the first thing you tried to do was identify the hero, and then identify the heroine and the villain, and or the villainess. And then you had things well under control. But Thackeray's was very much the exceptional case, and he felt no doubt obliged to put this subtitle on his title page, A Novel Without a Hero, to make it quite clear to everybody concerned that he hadn't just forgotten to put the hero in, but that the hero was not there quite deliberately and quite intentionally. And again, if one turns from literature, whether historical literature or fiction, if one turns from literature to life, one finds that 100 years ago, in public life, in England, probably on the continent also at that time, the great politicians, or at least the well-known politicians, the great writers, the great poets and explorers, were all regarded very much as public figures. They were very much in the public eye. If you think of people, for instance, like Gladstone, people like Tennyson, Browning, Newman, Dickens, Gordon, Florence Nightingale, they were all public figures. They were incredibly well known to the public, and they were hero-worshipped to an extent which we tend to find inconceivable today. For instance, if you go to some museums, you'll see scores, even hundreds of china figures made of these great people, all sorts of souvenirs about them. You may recollect that for a while, you probably know this, the poet Tennyson did live not very far from here, and there's a walk nearby which is called Tennyson's Walk. And apparently, especially towards the end of his life, he was very much pestered by people just coming to see him. And they'd hide in little groups behind trees. And then when they saw him coming along in his cloak and his broad-brimmed hat, they'd just peek out from behind the tree. There he goes, there's Tennyson. And sometimes there were hundreds of them. He used to feel absolutely hunted and absolutely persecuted. And everybody recognized or was able to recognize these great public figures and really look up to them and really sort of hero-worshipped them. And this is perhaps the reason, or at least one of the reasons, why the great Victorians appear, even in retrospect, even after 100 years, so very much larger than life. Even a comparatively minor figure, say like Matthew Arnold, seems very prominent when we look back on him. And these people occupied a place in the public life and in the public estimation, which we don't find politicians and writers and poets and artists occupying today. It's perhaps 30 or 40 years ago that the fashion started to change, perhaps just a little more than that. 30 or 40 or perhaps even 50 years ago, heroes went or started going out of fashion. And perhaps we can say, perhaps we can speculate that the Great War, the First Great War, had something to do with it. That wasn't a very heroic affair. But whether it had something to do with it, or whether it was the chief cause or not for the fact that heroes, or the idea of the hero, went out of fashion, there was a reaction, very much a reaction, against the whole conception of the hero. And the hero figure lost his popularity. In the golden days of the Victorians, a biography was an exercise in hagiography. As soon as a great Victorian died, within a year, usually, out came at least 3 thick volumes of memoirs. You can still find them in the public libraries. Sometimes 6 volumes, sometimes 7, collected life and letters. And some of the older libraries are full in their biographical sections of material of this sort. And reading through the lives and the letters, the collected letters, they were really selected, we know that now, but collected letters and memoirs of these eminent people, you got the impression that they really were someone. You saw, of course, the imposing external facade. It wasn't very often that you got a glimpse behind the scenes. Now, when that did sometimes happen, as in the case of Harold Froude, when his memoirs were published, or memoirs of him were published in 2 comparatively small volumes after his death, because he died young, some people were rather shocked by the revelations and the glimpses that they were given of his rather heretical opinions and so on. But usually that was not allowed to happen. The 3 volumes, or the 6 volumes, or the 8 volumes, were intended as a permanent monument. And there was the great man exhibited in all his glory, striking the pose or the attitude in which everybody wanted to see him. So, in this way, in the Victorian period, biography was very much an exercise in hagiography. But later on, after the hero had started going out of fashion, there was a tendency for biographies, when they were published, to become rather exercises in debunking. In debunking. And instead of trying to show how great the great man had been, as the Victorians did, how great the prominent men of the past had been, the new type of biography, the more debunking type of biography, tried to show, on the other hand, how small and how petty they really and truly were. And it's perhaps significant that at this period, biographies tended to become much shorter. Not 3 massive volumes, but 1 modest volume. And sometimes the volumes were very slim indeed. And as probably you know, the classic example of this sort of tendency is, or at least was, Lytton Strachey's The Great Victorians. A very slim volume devoted to no less than 4 Victorians, all in 1 volume. Well, the Victorians themselves were regarded as simply as shocking. That you don't give a great man or a great woman even 1 whole volume to themselves, you squeeze them all in this way. Within the covers of a single volume. It's always like burying 4 people in 1 grave. It's positively indecent. But at a later time, and we're perhaps still living in this period, or perhaps we're beginning to see it come to an end now, but at a later period, the hero seems to have disappeared from literature altogether. Nowadays, if you pick up a novel or a play, you don't expect to find the traditional sort of hero anymore. Except, of course, one may say that there are always exceptions in the more unsophisticated women's papers. In some quarters, in some literary quarters, we may say, in fact, the villain, or the personage who formerly would have been regarded as the villain of the novel or the play, has now become the hero. And of course, the hero has disappeared from public life. Mr. Gladstone was regarded as a hero. He was worshipped by many people. So was Disraeli. People used to write in asking for just a lock of his hair or something of this sort to enclose in a golden locket and wear round the neck. But we can't say that, or we can't feel that, about the politicians of our own day. If we were asked to select from the ranks of, say, the Labour Party or the Conservative Party or the Liberal Party, or even the Communist Party, or even though a party at all, even from the House of Lords, a really heroic figure, one who could be regarded as a hero, I think we'd be rather at a loss. And whether they were really hero or not, there's no question that not one of them is popularly regarded as a hero by people today in this country in any sense at all. So if the hero figure does survive at all in our day, it's only in very debased and perverted forms, such as that, for instance, of James Bond. And this, we may say, is a great pity. It's a great pity that things have come to this pass, that they've reached this extreme. Admittedly, the Victorians themselves very often went to extremes in their hero worship. They adulated, they glorified, they projected, they indulged in exercises in hagiography to a quite, in a way, unforgivable extent. But we've gone right to the opposite extreme, and their extreme was at least positive, whereas ours, unfortunately, is rather negative. And to us, the hero figure, the whole idea of the hero, is rather ridiculous, rather absurd. And this is perhaps, at least partly, because we cannot take seriously, as it were, someone who is serious about something. If we look at the whole question more in terms of principles, we may say that the hero is fundamentally the serious person. The hero is one who cares deeply about something and who is at the same time a person of exceptional, even of extraordinary, ability. So perhaps we may say that it's time that we got onto the middle path, avoiding these two extremes. The extreme of the Victorians and the extreme of our own day. It's time, in other words, that we revalued, perhaps upvalued, the hero. And in doing this, perhaps it would help if we dropped the word hero and used instead the word genius and regarded the hero as being also the man of genius, especially for the time being at least, as the man of literary or artistic or musical genius or any combination of these three.